The watch world is traditionally one of sober gray suits and boring silk neckties. But you walk into a room and you know instantly who Davide Cerato is. One of the first times I met him, he was wearing an almost neon blue jacket and bright orange trousers that matched a watch he had designed. He brings a completely different energy to the watch world, and it's infectious. You talk to him and you can't help but get just as excited as he is. He's currently the creative director and the head of watchmaking at Montblanc, but he's a true enthusiast, a longtime watch guy, and someone who isn't afraid to say the controversial thing that everyone else is thinking. He's the polar opposite of what you think of when you think of a Swiss watch executive. And that's partially because he's Italian, and he brings a sense of style and a little bit of flamboyance to basically everything he does. At Montblanc, Davide brings his knowledge of history, his eye for design, and his affinity for modern watchmaking together, and he's trying to increase the brand's credibility and standing with both everyday consumers and watch nerds, which is not an easy thing to do at the same time. Davide and I have had countless conversations about watches before. One notable time was in his open-top Morgan driving through the Valle de Joux to visit the Minerva manufacturer, but that's a story for another time. I'm excited to sit down with him and our senior editor, John, today to have another one of those extremely memorable conversations. I really hope you enjoy it. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Hook & Albert. Stay tuned later in the show to learn more about this global travel brand and their range of travel accessories. You can also learn more at hookandalbert.com. Cool. Thanks so much for being here, Davide. It's good to have you here in New York.
Great pleasure, Steven.
And you just came from Miami, right?
Yes, correct. 30 degree to 4.
That's a bit of a change.
A little bit tough.
And what were you in Miami for?
We were presenting some of the novelties to journalists to get a first flavor of the reaction of it.
And those are things we won't see until January,
correct,
right?
Correct, in SCHH.
Okay.
A little bit of patience.
Cool. Well, I think some of our readers probably know you a little bit, and they definitely know your work, but can you kind of tell us a little bit about who you are and your kind of background in the watch industry?
With great pleasure. Where do I start from? I think that to let you understand who am I and how I work, I should start from my brain. I have a characteristic that is not unique, but a little bit rare, which is my right and left brain are even. And most of the people are predominant one of the two, which means they are more creative to simplify or they are more analytic. And when you have those even, you can do both things exactly the same way, which created to me some issues at the beginning of my life and career and studies to understand in which direction heading while, you know, I started studying architecture and industrial design in a very, very creative way. Then I realized that I was missing a little bit the business part. Then I attended a business school and both were very interesting and very rich. And yeah, I struggled a little bit saying, okay, which is my direction, since when I had a kind of epiphany and I understood that my strength was exactly that one, exactly being able of handling both things, which at the end allows me to somewhere design with always already in mind, first the narrative and the story that I want to push for a particular line or particular products, and also somewhere having in my reptilian brain, I would say some, you know, fingertips of is what I'm designing good also for sales or not? Is
sure.
Good for, and the customer is not just, you know, a creative exercise in se, per se. So, yeah, that I think really gets already a first key. And that's what allowed me to integrate and to develop in these 15 years I've spent in the industry a very specific way of developing design, developing products, and developing narratives behind.
Nice. And people can probably tell by your accent, too, that you're not Swiss. You're not the, like, typical Swiss watch executive.
Completely true. I'm 100% Italian from Torino, north of Italy. And by the way, the birthplace of, I would say, the car dream. I was born in a place where you have, you know, Pininfarina, Bertone, Zagato, and this mythical guy just next door. And in a moment where the car industry was completely booming, and in Torino there was a fantastic car show as big as the Geneva one. Today, unfortunately, it's over. It doesn't exist since years, but it really allowed me to get completely into cars. I think the first motor show I visited with my father, I was three and a half, something like that, and I saw all of them. So I remember all the incredible launches of Ferraris, and you know, just sitting on the shoulders of my father, or having to expect the people to move to see these incredible products that were, you know, like a spacecraft, red spacecraft that were appearing every year. Very exciting.
That must have been a really spectacular setting in which to grow up, and really inspirational, I would think, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then my studies in architecture and in industrial design at the Politecnico di Torino were happening in a moment where the city was really growing very much into, you know, modern art. There is a fantastic cinema museum that has been settled in the Mole Antonelliana that has been for a long time the highest monument in Europe. A very, very creatively exciting place.
And what, after all of that, you know, kind of growing up in a car culture, studying architecture and industrial design, what then drew you to kind of cross the northern border and head into Switzerland and venture into watches?
Yeah, in reality, I crossed the border when I was still in Italy, because the first jump that I did into the industry was with Officine Panerai.
Kind of a fitting way to start.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I had this after having done very different things, because I've been working in marketing, in fast-moving consumer goods for Ferrero, for example. That is an incredible school of marketing in Italy. It's really considered like Procter & Gamble in US, with an incredible philosophy for product, for quality, and with an incredible advance in terms of a marketing approach. That was really, really seminal for me. And then I moved to France. I work in consumer electronics, both on the design side, strategic design, and on the marketing side, completely different environment, but already melting technology and aesthetics, you know, the external design and coping with, you know, a technology inside. Then I went back in Italy and worked in advertising for the first advertising agency, that is Armando Testa. Unfortunately, it's completely unknown outside, but it was founded really by one of the big guys of that created advertising in the 50s. And I work on cars for the Fiat Group on Lancia. So again, coping with this fantastic balance between you know, external shapes and chassis and then engines and all of this. And I think that somewhere also my, you know, coming back to my brain structure, I was a little bit settled already for to work with something that has both an external shape that is completely exposed to creativity and an internal engine that you need to understand to be able of developing itself, like the movement, and then matching in a very clever, virtuous way this internal engine and the external chassis.
Nice.
Were you into watches at all before you accepted the position with Panerai?
I was, in the sense that I'm a kid of the 70s, so my very first watch was a digital Casio, you know, in a dark blue, navy blue plastic with the display that was in LED, red LED. By the way, yeah. I saw here in New York in an hotel a display of the floors exactly the same as it was, and the time was not displayed all time, but you had to push a button to get this red LED with the time. And looking back, it looks like a Star Wars.
Yeah, totally.
Completely Star Wars watch. And then I remember very, very precisely and strongly when my father teach me how to read time with in an analogical way with the hands of a watch. And that was really, to me, was an epiphany. It was really like when you learn how to write really getting the grammar of things and being able of making up phrases with sense and then poetry out of cold words. It was exactly like this, you know, getting the logic that was behind this magic machine to tell time was really something very, very strong. And then, I mean, I lived in Italy in the years where the Swatch phenomenon boom and people were queuing outside of the watches, and it was a lot about design and style, and as always in Italy. And I had the luck to receive from my father and my grandfather and grand-grandfather some fantastic watches. So to also be able of owning them with all the emotional value that you get always around it. So yeah, that's the way in which I was into it before joining.
And what years were you at Panerai?
I joined in 2001 to 2006, around.
Okay. So those were really heydays of Panerai.
Those were really instrumental years.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for the production of the in-house movements were really coming online.
Absolutely. We launched the very first one. Cologne was still involved at the time. I had the pleasure and the chance to work a little bit with him. Bodino was still really included into it, and they were very, very exciting years. And Panerai definitely crashed me completely into the overall watchmaking world, without any doubt, with this such strong and unique Italian DNA and the Navy mythical saga and the Decima Mass and all. It was really, I got completely the disease, the one that you cannot heal.
It must also have been interesting to kind of encounter diehard collectors for the first time that way, because people who weren't collecting during that time, or who don't kind of like study these things for a living, I guess. I mean, I wasn't collecting around that time, but it's hard to understand what Panerai was like at that time. I mean, people were rabid, and it was all about having, you know, getting as many of the limited editions as you can. And really it was almost like some weird combination of like watches and baseball cards, and also kind of like what Swatch was in the 90s. So what was it like, kind of your first industry experience being with that kind of collector base?
It was really striking and seminal, and really such hectic and intense. It was really, really with a lot of energy and not only, but we at the same time, at the time, we were really working on the campaign, on the overall image, on the boutiques, the boutique concept, all this beautiful teak wood application with the portals and all this way of leveraging, the warmth of teak wood and this navel finning and a little bit of this adventures, it was very strong. And if I have to add something to give you another key to understand who I am, I started drawing and designing far before I started writing, and I started doing strips and comics very, very early. I was really a small kid, and I loved to, invent stories. And then I was designing the bubbles, and then I was giving to my mother to write inside the bubble what were the discussion and the stories. So, yeah, I think that, getting these inventing stories, or getting the real story and being able to tell it in the right way, at that moment, Panerai was really very strongly about that, this epic saga of these bold guys that were taking huge risk and, adventuring in muddy waters, in the middle of mines, and, in the middle.
It was romantic, right?
It was absolutely romantic, absolutely romantic. And yeah, perhaps, who knows, it was a little bit of the beginning of the thrill for the adventure feeling that today has become so much relevant in society. There was definitely something like that.
Yeah. And so you went from Panerai, and then your next kind of adventure, if we'll keep with the adventure theme, was to go to Tudor, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. After, almost 5 years at Panerai, I got this opportunity to join a completely new adventure. I get in contact with a headhunter. We did not disclose me the company that was behind the thing. So I flew to Zurich to meet this guy in an hotel without knowing what this was about. And there I discovered that was Rolex, and that was the idea of relaunching Tudor. So which sounded very, very interesting. And which made me move to Switzerland, to Geneva. It was 2006. So,
okay. So you were in Milan before with Panerai.
Correct. Yes. Exactly. Based in Milan for the world. I moved to Geneva. So now I'm completely Italian, but I could apply for the Swiss passport, and I will definitely do so.
It's a good thing to have. Yeah.
Exactly. Definitely.
And you mentioned you started at Tudor right as you were relaunching the brand. It was also when Tudor came back to the United States. So it's a time that's very important for those of us who follow watches.
Yeah, totally.
That's when a lot of us became reacquainted with what Tudor was and saw what it would eventually be.
Absolutely. We really worked for some time, I think 3 or 4 years, to really settle the grammar of the brand. I always look setting up a brand a little bit like is writing or writing poetry. You know, you get the words, then you get the grammar to do phrases, then you have phrases that can not mean anything, and then you put together phrases and you create a story, or you create a poem, and that is where you really push it into a completely different level, and where you are able of speaking to the heart of people and really raise huge emotion into people, bondings, projections. That's exactly what we did at that time, with a lot of work. But very, very exciting period. Again, a little bit with the same kind of energy that was in Panerai before, in a moment when you are really setting the basics and completely resettle everything, because it was completely forgotten somewhere. That had clearly been stopped for a while, in particular in the US. And that was really exciting to resettle the full product and the logic behind the product, and to dig into the archives and find very interesting stories that were not exactly the same than Rolex, to get out really the specific character off, and then by setting a full environment of communication, of retail, and so on, rebuilding completely the brand.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that we take for granted now in, 2018, this idea of looking in the archive, right? Mm. And back in that time, when the first Black Bays and Heritage Chronographs came out, these were really watches that were doing something totally different than what most of the industry was doing. Like, this was still the kind of latter days of the, like, everything was big, mm-hmm. everything was gaudy. It was about how many complications you could pack in. It was about, super bold design. And I don't mean bold like adventurous. I mean bold like just big, really in your face. And to do something like release a, dive watch that looked like something from the 1970s was at that time really innovative. I mean, what did it feel like at that time to be kind of swimming against the current, I guess, of what the industry was doing, especially at a place like Rolex?
Yeah, it was incredibly exciting, and the effect was really a tsunami wave. At Basel World of 2010, the first Heritage Chrono that we presented, it was a huge, huge, huge buzz. Anyone was expecting that from a dormant brand coming back. And everyone was expecting that kind of, power in the design. I mean, it really, really pulled out as being one of the strongest pieces at the fair. And it really put, again, Tudor very quickly on the radar in an incredible way. We were probably really the very first brand to do that.
And I remember it was really, really sensational, because I think a lot of us thought that, the aspirational, more affordable younger brand of Rolex was actually in some ways as cool, or maybe even cooler than Rolex on some level.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really interesting time, certainly for Tudor and for watches.
Yeah, and since then, I mean, we've seen obviously the pendulum swing in that direction, right? Like now that's kind of the bread and butter of most kind of like, I would say, mid to high end sport watch collections is kind of heritage models. We've really seen that language be adopted. And I think even into the not explicitly heritage branded products, we've seen this kind of design
retro
language.
Vintage designs. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It's become a big part of I think, the like collective vocabulary, right?
Without any doubt, the downside of this is that I think doing proper vintage reinterpretation, I mean, taking the spirit of incredibly strong products or design signs from the past and contaminate them with very in the zeitgeist contemporary elements in such a way that you can, you know, channel in a kind of a travel into time the elements to create something that is again very strong and again very iconical. And by the way, this is exactly the process through which an icon is created, is something. And then just releasing a replica of an old watch is nothing, is like anyone can scan and copy an old watch and redo it, and I don't see any value in that. And I, by the way, you don't see any designer or any developer to do that, and you just need a nice scanner and a 3D printer and you can do it. So yeah, all of this has a little bit banalized the concept in itself, is draining value out of it, and is for sure confusing a lot and customer and clients that see similar proposal at different price point from different brands, those who really have a story and those who have not at all. And it's very difficult to distinguish properly value and good work from just copycat.
Now for a look at this week's sponsor. Hook & Albert is a modern travel brand for professionals who are always on the go. Over the last 4 weeks, we've looked at four of their keystone products. And these include the Garment Weekender, which is a combination garment bag and duffel bag, the Getaway Duffel, which is a lightweight leather bag perfect for a weekend away, the Laptop Briefcase, which is a modern take on the traditional form that holds all of your work needs, and then the Dop Kit, which is a form follows function version of a travel staple. Having spent some time with these products, I can say that they satisfy the desire for something that feels luxurious while also filling the need for something that's actually going to perform. Starting next week, we're going to have a series of interviews with Hook & Albert founder Adam Schoenberg. He's going to walk us through how the brand got started, how they developed their design philosophy, and why they wake up and do what they do every day, trying to make your travel just a little bit better. For now, if you want to learn more, go check out hookandalbert.com and be sure to stay tuned for more. Let's get back to the show. We've seen over the last couple of years, as kind of heritage design takes over, it's inevitably, or maybe not inevitably, a trend, right? And at some point, people will want things that feel new and feel different. And the industry really seems to be focused on looking back and looking to the archives. And I wonder what's going to happen when, after years of kind of rehashing old ideas and reinterpreting old ideas, often in great ways, what's going to happen when we need new ideas? Do you think there are going to be people there to have those new ideas? Do you think the kind of spirit is going to be there to have those new ideas?
I think so. And I think definitely the future will be finding a new direction that will be more looking forward into the future than looking back. But I still need that vintage and retro is a streamline, and it will be theirs, which means that it will be there. So for the early adopters or the trendsetter will be there still for a while. I think that the real challenge is that those designs cannot come by themselves. I don't think a single designer can support this shift from looking back to looking forward. And we are discussing with friends and other designers and journalists in these last months a lot to this point. And we are really wondering about why designs of the 70s are so seminal and why those designs are so powerful, and at the end somewhere, you know, they polarize so much attention compared to any other moment in time. And I really believe that it is because it was perhaps the last moment when we had overall as a society still a very positive and almost naive vision of the future based on technology and the possibilities and the power and the opportunities given by technology, in a future that was talking very much through the design of objects, you know, through material shapes that were the kind of supporting evidence of the capacity of a human creativity to project itself into forward looking and forward thinking and into new ways of, you know. You remember that was the time when we were absolutely convinced that in 2018 we would have had cars flying and not with wheels anymore and landed on Earth. We were thinking about traveling in space with incredible speed, or dematerializing and rematerializing somewhere and colonizing, making colonies in other, that was a kind of collective positive dream. And then going forward, the 80s and 90s, with all the issues that we had, this vision completely collapsed. And a good example was the film The Matrix. You know, the future was just, there was no future at the end. There was no future, there was no reality. And any possible future projection was negative, you know, which in effect, I mean, unfortunately, so many aspects of society, of the evolution of the environment, the climate, the growth of the population and so on, push. But I still that now what we really miss and what we really need is to create again a positive future, a vision for the future, to project again into few years or decades ahead. And this is not cannot just be a design exercise, but must be a, you know, like an art movement, must be an open discussion between sociologists and philosopher and designers coming from different universes and environment to find, to build up a new vision, to build up a kind of le terroir, the land, you know, the positive land that can grow this future vision. But that is the big, nice, great challenge that we all have to set up. And then once this is starting, then it will be easier to shape into that vision particular projection that can be a new direction in design, that can be a new direction in the history, in the industry or in ergonomies and so on. And if I look at the car world, and I'm, you know, that I'm very much fond of it and passionate for it, even there is not anymore so much, because I remember a Geneva Motor Show probably 6 years ago that was all about electric cars and sustainability and, low impact and very small box cars. And I mean, the whole pleasure and dream about driving and about motorsport and about car was like a little bit disappeared in the back. And then if you look 3 years after, it was SUV everywhere in such a way that even small cars that are not four-wheel drives now take the shape of an SUV to vehicle this, you know, adventurous outdoor feeling. And now even sports cars are coming back like crazy on top of the SUV. So we are completely back into speed and performance and noise, and which are, I mean, the elements of the passion for motorsport. Even if, for sure, electric cars are there and have become a part of the market as much as, you know, auto-conducted vehicles and so on. But a little bit how it happened with the connected watches in the watch world.
And even Lamborghini has an SUV, right?
Exactly. And even Ferrari now wants to make an SUV, which I cannot really see, but apparently
I can't quite
something
imagine what
is
that looks
going
like,
to happen.
I want to touch on really quickly, you said something about the connected watch and the way that kind of, you know, represents a, not a change in the watch industry, but kind of an alternate perspective. And I think that ties in really interestingly to what you're doing now at Montblanc, right? Montblanc has this, you know, kind of series of, you know, kind of amazing, I don't want to say departments, but kind of different parts of the brand. And so you have, you know, Core, Mont Blanc, and then you have Minerva. So you have this amazing heritage and like really, truly high-end watchmaking. And then you also have this division that does things like the smartwatches. And so you have everything from like the most traditional hand-wound, you know, monopusher chronograph movements to a smartwatch with its own proprietary set of apps and its own hardware and everything. So how do you think about, you know, the brand identity when you're trying to cover such a broad portfolio and service those different audiences, but also make it feel cohesive and part of the same universe?
Sure. But the first point is, if we look at the mechanical watchmaking part, it's the third time that I'm living this very exciting, thrilling moment of construction and really setting of a brand. What we are doing in Montblanc now since 3 years, but already started before by Jerome, is really setting up something completely unique and reshaping completely the identity, as you say, of Montblanc watches. We are completely integrating Minerva and Montblanc in such a way that these are two assets of the same company and are really part of the same grammar and the same language. So Montblanc is Minerva and Minerva is Montblanc. And the new watches that we are doing in Montblanc are completely making reference to fantastic watches from the Minerva Museum in such a way that they are just building up again the red line, the fil rouge between the past and the present. We are using and leveraging the fantastic Minerva movements, handmade and finished for limited edition and numbered edition and DIN in effect. And we are setting up a system where we have new lines, new product lines like Time Walker, like 1858, like Star Legacy, with a very strong distinctive design, with really rooted into the history of Minerva, Time Walker, the stopwatches and the counters of the saga of the timekeeping and the birth of a chronograph of the first half of the 20th century, 1858, the military watches of the 30s and the 40s, and Star Legacy, the early pocket watches and wristwatches. And we have, in effect, in each product line, and this is becoming really the signature of Montblanc, three levels of a technical content. We have a first level that we call the core, which is up to 5,000 euros with ETAs, Sellita, Dubois de Prat modules. I mean, movement existing on the market, then fine-tuned, customized for us, but that are very reliable because out there since decades and that they fine-tuned their quality, so very reliable. Sure. And allowing us, they are clearly for us the best option today, to be able to offer very interesting, strong enterprise watches and a lot of value. Then 5,000 to let's say 25,000, we have a segment that we are growing a lot, which is called manufacture, where we are proposing our own in-house calibers or modules developed inside the group and with a lot of value, like, for example, the Geosphere.
Sure, which is what you're wearing on your wrist right
absolutely,
now.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is the one I'm wearing with a lot of pleasure every day. And over 25, where we have the Minerva movements, all the fantastic chronograph monopusher and the Exo Tourbillon, really made up for collectors. And all of this is encapsulated into every line, which... to me, it's very interesting because I don't think that the collectors that are buying the Minerva One are disturbed by the fact that there are in the same range also more accessible pieces. And on the contrary, the people that are buying entry-price watches, they aspire to be able to buy more expensive, more complex, more valuable watches on the top. And also... We are one of the few brands that can really accompany them in their, you know, life cycle of watch lovers and watch collectors. And if they grow their knowledge and their means, they can grow within Montblanc without being forced to change brand to find something else.
Do you see a lot of that? A lot of customers who come in, maybe they buy a Time Walker manufacturer, they buy a Geosphere, and then a year or 2 years later, you see them buying something like a monopusher chronograph?
Definitely. And we also see a lot of collectors that make their first dip into the water through a Geosphere or a Time Walker chronograph, or, for example, the Nicola Riosec that we have redesigned inside Star Legacy, you know, to get a kind of very first contact. And then once they are convinced, 2 months later, 3 months later, they step up and they start to buy one of the limited edition. Quite often.
Do you ever have collectors who maybe are collecting things like Patek Vacheron AP, whether it's chronographs or other complicated watches, who come and they know the real watchmaking chops that you guys have in Minerva, but they kind of have a hard time, you know, getting used to the fact that they're wearing a watch that says Montblanc on the dial? Do you ever, how do you, I guess, I'm sure you do have customers like that, but I guess, how do you kind of explain that proposition to them?
The answer is yes, we have, and I think we will have more and more. And the reason why we have is that, as you said, they know exactly what they are buying, and they know that for 25 to 30,000, they are buying chronograph monopusher with a level of work and then finishing that is absolutely at the level of Patek Philippe. And even if they spend 30,000, they are spending by far less than the first option that we have, that they have as a second choice. So, and since we made the only watch auction where we could sell one of those pieces for 60,000 Swiss franc, there is also a very first thread that shows that the investment is worth, and that most probably, as they felt from the very beginning for the first one that we did, those watches are going to take more and more value, and already they are more valuable as soon as you purchase them. Then for sure we still have a long way to go, and we still have to work on our watchmaking legitimacy and on the fact of convincing those purists that Montblanc is capable of doing watches as a watch specialist brand, even if beside it we also make writing instruments, and we also make leather, fantastic leather products, and so on, which is very special to Montblanc. That's why we have to manufacture in Switzerland, a great group of people sitting there under my responsibility, and we are leveraging 160 years of watchmaking knowledge, and that's why we are able to propose this kind of a complication of design and of value proposition.
I've often wondered about Montblanc because there really is no other brand like it, certainly that is operating in the watch space. How do the different product categories communicate with each other? Is everyone aware of how the watches fit into the larger kind of output of Montblanc?
Sure, we are really working all together under the direction of Nicolas Baretsky, and he's the one that at the end is really, you know, balancing all these things. We are really working all together, because at the end the brand is the Maison is one and is Montblanc, and each category in somewhere is nurturing and bringing different parts into this wider portfolio. Watches are a very, very important driver of luxury, of rarity, prestige, craftsmanship. So in this sense, they are really essential for the Maison in the long term to really make it grow, aspire toward the high in such a way that it is perceived as a real global luxury Maison.
I want to talk also, I want to go back to what you said at the very beginning, which is, mm-hmm. you talked about the fact that your left brain and right brain are even, and you kind of approach everything that way, and that can end up being your biggest strength. You're in a position at Montblanc right now where you're sort of doing two jobs at once. You know, you're doing jobs that at many places would be broken out into two jobs. So you're in charge of the design and the actual product, but you're also in charge of kind of strategy and marketing and the business side of things. How do you balance those two things, and how do they impact one another? How does business impact how you design products, and how does the design of the products impact how you think about the business?
Mm-hmm. They are completely interconnected, and the good things when you can integrate all these dimensions is that you can get the most value out of it very clearly. That's why when I joined, we have created a business unit dedicated to watches, sitting in Switzerland, leveraging all the best people, knowledges, passion that we have to get out the most of it very clearly. Everything is interconnected, and that's why being able to integrate it one into the other still while you are developing is very good, because it allows you to have a critical speed to market. You go by far quicker than if each step the product or the project is passed to someone else who pick up from scratch and has to reinvent. And also at the end, you get a consistency that you will never get again if you, in a Tayloristic way, you start to divide each single step to create a kind of artificial product. Everything is deeply interconnected. Everything, you know, we get demands from the market or comments that come from particular customers or collectors that are taken into consideration to push new development in terms of, I don't know, price positioning or particular complication or particular colors or particular genders and so on. And then we get, you know, design trends that are coming and that are showing ways to, you know, give a better watches and even stronger watches to our customer and please them the most that we can. Or there are, you know, technical developments or elements that allow us to push forward to even new universes, and I mean, in a way, the connected watch has worked that way, really giving us the possibility to add a part of it. I was referring to it as for cars because it happened something quite similar.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
As much as the first electric car, everyone said, "Ooh, now the normal engine car is dead." When the connected watches came,
not quite, yeah.
A lot of your colleagues were saying, "Okay, now it's the end of mechanical watchmaking.
We all better be looking for jobs."
And now reality is, again, it has become a very solid, important segment, completely disconnected from mechanical watches, growing, very interesting, but just a part of, without really killing or taking the place of anything. And that's the way in which Montblanc has approached it. We have been jumping into the train very early because we partnered with Google for this, and we knew
sure.
since the very beginning that Google has picked up very few brands and positioning them very well to avoid any overlaps. And we knew that the one that were not joining the train in the beginning were just will never have joined. So we were in with the Summit One, which was very, very successful, really over our expectation. And now we are just presenting the second release, which
is... just came out, what, like 2 weeks ago,
last
right?
week, exactly,
yeah.
With a smaller size, 42 millimeter, with a new electronic module inside, really more powerful. So expanding in a dramatic way the potential reach of it, because 46 to 42 makes really
a huge
big difference. But all of this is really on the side and is not connected in terms of product to what we are doing on the watchmaking, the mechanical watchmaking.
Okay, so I've got to ask, you're a pretty stylish guy. I mean, people can't see you through the magic of radio, but, you know, double-breasted suit, candy-striped shirt, bow tie, vintage glasses, you're a stylish guy. Anybody who knows you knows that. What can we see, whether it's in the 1858 or Time Walker, where does your style come through in these products, or does it?
Yes, I think that, it's not me saying it, I very often get the comment from clients, from journalists, from retailers, that they see a particular vintage touch, retro touch, that is becoming a little bit my style, and that is coming out from particular products. In this sense, I think that Geosphere in 1858 is probably, someone just told me when we were in Miami, that is so much you. And yeah, in a way, yes, for sure. You know, when you design at a certain moment after years and years, you develop your own style. And I mean, the magic is really being able of using it the right way to express the DNA of the brand. And I think here, really integrating Minerva and Montblanc, we are doing something very powerful. We are keeping alive, we are reshaping this fantastic, unique history in watchmaking with a face that is really sexy. We are able, I think we have brought into Montblanc a very sexy twist, a very desirable, emotional, round, sound touch into the watches. Being, by the way, 1858, being Time Walker, the new Panda dials have been welcome, especially the cappuccino, in a very strong way. And what we are doing now on the classical side is hitting the same level of sophistication and of sexiness, which we are all very proud of. Star Legacy, very, very successful also on a very classical range, and a sure. range that is rooted into 21 years of different star lines inside Mont Blanc, but now expressed really in a sharper, stronger, more emotional, more watchmaking cultured way. And a new, another new line, a little bit more vintage, that we are going to present in 2 months, that I think really shows in a very clear way now the 360 degree of the structure that we are putting behind our watch offer.
I know Jack got to see it this past week and had nice things to say. I haven't seen much, but seems exciting.
Yeah, very. And I mean, your colleagues, which are always the forerunners of what happens, were the very first to have a vision of the overall structure. You know, now after 3 years of making, they see the new collection that was received very positively, but they also see the perspective and the full structure, and they see very well which is the direction and the vision, and it looks like it's very clear, and it's very interesting. So
great. Well, our engineer is waving at me from the other side of the window here, so we're about to get chased out of the studio in about 5 minutes. So we tend to finish the show up with a little bit of a kind of lightning round, a couple quick questions, and then some cultural recommendations. Yeah. So here are a couple questions. You can answer these as short as you can.
Okay.
So what's a watch that's caught your eye recently?
What is the watch that's caught my eye? The Geosphere.
All right.
Now, I really believe that this one is going to become the icon of Mont Blanc in terms of watchmaking, that really bears a very, very strong identity, together with an expression of the world timer that is the easiest available today to the market. So I think it's going to become it's perhaps the new Black Bay of Mont Blanc.
Awesome. Well, that's a good segue into question number two, which is, what's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
What's the best place? I absolutely love Japan. I'm absolutely in love with Japan. So yeah, when I go to Tokyo, it's always a travel into another dimension, especially in aesthetical and cultural way. Mm-hmm. It's really so much enriching. And you know, the Uber driver this morning was telling me, just looking in my eyes, that perhaps I had some Asian origins. And perhaps that's why I love so much Japan. Who knows? Perhaps in a previous life.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever received, and who did it come from?
That's a difficult one. Perhaps the fact of not caring too much of the feedback that you receive from the others. I think that designers really need to be designing is always seen as a very nice, creative, relaxing, meaningful, process. But in reality, a part of it is the tough one. That is, once you are really sure that what you have designed is something powerful, is being able of defending it through all the different filters and discussion and approval, to not compromise on those key elements that if you take off are killing the idea. And and going through that process, being able of explaining and defending and keeping good and fighting, it's really fundamental.
Great. And then, do you have a guilty pleasure? What's your guilty pleasure?
Ooh, that's another difficult one. I really, really, really love to. I'm a fly fisherman and a fisherman since I was really a kid. But really, I mean, I was asking my mother for a stick to pretend I was fishing on my when I was walking with her, when I was probably even not 1 year old, my guilty pleasure is really spend time alone into the wild, you know, in the middle of the Russian tundra, fly fishing for Atlantic salmons. That is really a magic moment.
Perfect. So then the last thing we finish every show up with is a cultural recommendation. Mm-hmm. So what is something you recommend our listeners check out after they're done with this show? It can be a book, a film, a museum, a place you've been, just something you recommend they go take a look at.
Mm-hmm. I think that I would definitely recommend to visit the Frank Gehry Bilbao Modern Art Museum. It's such a special place. It was the only museum that I visited when I was walking inside the museum and really crying. So much I was overwhelmed by the beauty, the volume, the light, that it was incredible. I'm reading different books from Tadao Ando, where he explains the thinking that is behind this architecture, and those are completely mind-blowing. I really recommend people to read it. And for a designer, I mean, I've been studying design and architecture, and architects, I think, are really the best at explaining the roots of their thinking and the way in which they develop their process. I always read, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, Frank Gehry, way of explaining their thinking. Yeah, those books are really like enlightening.
Perfect. John, how about you?
Sure. I would like to recommend this series on Netflix called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it yet, but yeah.
And it's a, so this is basically, it's based on a New York Times bestselling book. The author and the star of it is Samin Nosrat. And what she basically does is teach you how to become a smarter and better cook through mastering salt, fat, acid, and heat. And in particular, so it's just four episodes. And I would really recommend the one on salt, which was shot mostly in Japan. And you really learn how to use miso in soy sauce to great effect. So I would say check that out.
Man, you guys are two for two. I'm checking out. I'm ordering these to Dow Ando Bucks, and I'm going to go home and watch the show, man. Yeah, my recommendation is a book. I'm not quite finished with it, but it's called The Auctioneer. It was recommended to me by actual former Hodinkee Radio guest Michael Weisberg. Shout out to Michael. And it's the autobiography of Simon de Pury, formerly of Philips de Pury. And it's this just very strange sort of, it's his autobiography, but it's actually more of like a biography of the auction world of the 20th century, looking at how the, you know, Christie's Sotheby's dynamic really came out of this strange post-war atmosphere in London, and the rest of the world was kind of the Wild West, and his kind of creation of Philips de Pury was part of this attempt to kind of like conquer that world, and there were highs and lows, and it's lots of fascinating characters. In fact, some of the like weirdest characters you can imagine. And it's fun and entertaining and a quick read. So I'd recommend you check that out.
Sounds great.
Cool. Fantastic. Well, Davide, thank you so much for coming. This is awesome. After I read these Tadao Ando books, we're going to have to get a bottle of red wine and talk again.
With great pleasure. Thank you very much for hosting me.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Thanks so much to Davide and to John for joining us. This week's episode was recorded at Miratone Studios in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.